1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock. And we've been hearing from listeners who have been through the experience of being in a coma. Lucy Martin, good afternoon. Have we got
Hello.
Hello, Lucy, how are you?
Hello, I just turned off the radio, sorry.
Well done.
Hi, no, I've turned off the radio,
thanks, Lucy.
Sorry.
Yeah, Lucy, you got in touch with us and talk us through. You had the most extraordinary story. Take us right back to the very beginning. You suffered from vertigo for many years.
I did. I suffered from vertigo for about 30 years. So that was dizziness and feeling that the ground was coming up to meet me. So every time I went to the doctor with the pains in my head and the dizziness, they said to me, oh, that's the vertigo, and I'd get medication and I'd carry on. And then in about 2010, I went to America for a week and I had a really bad episode of the vertigo on the plane. I thought I was, you know, really sick, and I started dropping things. And so it was suggested to me that when I'd get home that I would get an MRI to see if this vertigo had got worse or what was happening. So I did. I got an MRI, and the next day I was called in to say that there was quite a large meningioma or tumour on my brain that it had been growing for possibly 30 years.
Oh, my God.
And it was wound around the motor part of my brain, the part of my brain that affects the, you know, my motor facilities, like as in walking and movement. So they arranged for an operation almost straight away, and I had the operation, and something went wrong during the operation. So there was a bleed on my brain, which caused me to have a stroke. And then it was quite bad, so they put me in an induced coma. So I didn't know this was happening to me, obviously. So the first, I kind of knew that was when I woke up. But my experience of a coma was the most frightening thing in my entire life. It was very frightening for my family watching me. But for me, I was plunged into somewhere totally different.
Now, Lucy, how long were you in that coma?
I was in the coma for about 3 weeks, 20-something days, 22, 23 days.
And when you had been going in for that surgery, had you been warned that this could possibly be an outcome?
Now that part of my memory was gone. My short-term memory was gone when I came out, but I talked it with my partner afterwards. What we remember, or what I remember, was that I thought it was kind of life or death. If I survived the operation, that would be great, but that something could go wrong. But I thought it was life or death. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that I could be in a coma. I didn't know that I could wake up without being able to walk, without being able to move my hand, being in nappies, not being able to feed myself. I didn't know all of that. And I didn't know that I would have like a raging infection, which caused me to be like in a parallel universe. So I thought I was stuck in a cavern under a farm building. And it was
this
really
is when you, I'm sorry, sorry. So sorry to cut across you, Lucy. This is when you were actually in the coma itself.
In the coma. So I didn't know I was in a coma. I thought I was in under a cavern trying to get out, trying to carry my daughter on my back. And I knew that I didn't have my full facilities in that dream or in that hallucination. And I was trying to carry my daughter out towards the light. I would have had, I don't want to upset any of your listeners, I would have had some really terrible experiences in it, where there was the smell of burning flesh and the scenario that went with it. So I don't want to upset anyone, but it was really scary. That was the worst part of it, where they set people on fire. And
so these were kind of visions you were having?
They were, like, it was, they were as real to me as sitting in my kitchen, though. They were that real. So they poured oil over people and burnt them, and I could smell the burning flesh.
How terrifying.
It was terrifying, and I kept opening doors looking for my partner searching for him, not understanding where he was, because he had promised he wouldn't leave. My family had promised me that they'd be there, and apparently they were.
So were there people trying to talk to you and trying to get through to you and with you?
Apparently, but I didn't know that. I only found that afterwards. They never left me. There was somebody there all of the time. They played music, they talked, they rubbed, they did everything.
And did they see any? And did they see any of this distress on you while they were watching over you?
I just ask, no, you didn't see any distress on me, did you, when I was in that?
No, when you were in the coma,
okay, he said when I was in the coma, I was in a complete neutral state. My son tells me what they just kept doing was watching the monitors to see if the numbers were rising on the machines. That was where they were worried, you know, because if the numbers went up, it would be
bad.
Worse, you know, and there was a stage. My husband says on the 16th day of the coma where he was advised that things mightn't turn out well, that the brain was continuing to damage itself, and this may not be a good outcome, you know.
And so this is said, because you actually had a brain infection on top of the stroke, the bleed that you had.
Yes, 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 yes.
And do the doctors think that this may have contributed to these very vivid hallucinations you were having?
They didn't really understand the coma so much. What they said to him, to my husband, was that what they understood is that while I was in a coma, all those things that I experienced would be like flashes, as quick as television flashes to the outward person. But for me, they were like a living hell, do you know? Because they went on forever for me,
It sounds like the worst anxiety dream to be trapped in forever.
It was the absolute, it's the one thing that I am ever petrified of ever going into a coma again, you know. There was one good part. So there was the horrible part, the smell of burning flesh and all of those things and not being able to get out. And then there was a place I went at one stage where all people, they told me, and the people that I met in this coma, who told me this is where people come after they die. And there were people that I knew there. I didn't know their faces, but I knew them. And I remember them gathering me into their lap. It felt like my grandmother, you know, pulling me in. And I was so happy. It was such a happy place, that place.
And these were not actual people that you could recognise and say who they were, but you felt that they were familiar to you.
Yeah, it was like as if their faces were blank, but I could, like, it felt like a woman with a long skirt with her legs, you know, the way older people sometimes open their legs with a long skirt and pull you in to hug you. Mm-hmm. It was like that. And it was a place where they were preparing for dead people to come, you know, so we could see.
And this was all conscious. You have this very, very clear
vivid
memory of that was
very, very vivid, making food for the people who were coming.
Are you religious, Lucy?
Am I religious? I have, I would have a faith. I wouldn't be great at, when I came out, I thought it was because I had done wrong things in my life that this had happened to me. So I would have a faith from a childhood, but I wouldn't be the best Catholic, if you know what I mean.
But did this feel like you were touching on heaven and hell? Because
when I tried to make sense of it afterwards, it did. But at the time, there wasn't that kind of decision making. It was like you were falling from one place to another. Do you know? And it was interrupted because while I was in the coma, then they took me. They took me to have my brain washed out a couple of times to try and clear the infection.
Yeah.
And you had, love?
The infections
Is that your partner there?
It is, yeah. He's saying, what happened? Because you see, obviously I'm not the best person of telling you what was happening on the outside. He said it was after they brought me out of the coma that they went back into the brain to do the washouts of my brain.
Right.
There was very opposite kind of, I was so scared when I came out of the coma though. I was petrified. I was actually suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which was diagnosed by the psychologist in Headway.
Because of what you because saw or thought you saw in the coma?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. Lucy, would you stay there? Will you stay with us, please?
Yes, of course.
Go anywhere because your story is so extraordinary.
Okay.
But I want to go because we've got Barra Fitzgibbon on another line.
Yes.
And Barra, you were in a coma much more recently, just in the last year.
That's right, Katie, yeah. So basically because of COVID, when it first broke here, really reaching its peak at the very beginning of the first wave here in the UK. And I got COVID and I was like your contributor there, put into an induced coma. But the difference was I knew all about it. And I was briefed by ICU kind of next steps and what would be happening. Now, I kind of looked forward to it. And I'll tell you why. I hadn't slept for about a week before I arrived into hospital because with COVID symptoms, obviously you're coughing and it's very uncomfortable. So I had no sleep. But when I saw an anaesthetist and they gave me the option to go to sleep, I kind of semi-embraced it. But at the same time, I was told I'd have a 60% chance of making it, which kind of felt very low now. It felt quite reasonable at the time, actually. But I remember
You had a 40% chance of coming out of it.
That's right. And that's when they said, look, you need to contact family and friends. Now, this is the bit that I found the trickiest, was the conversations I had to have going into the coma. Like your first contributor there, I did have hallucinations as well during the coma, but it was explained to me why that happens. The consultants explained to me because the amount of antivirals they were putting into my system was the reason why I was having these crazy hallucinations. Not nearly as nightmarish now as your first contributor there, but certainly hallucinations nonetheless. So that's where I was with that coma, yeah. I was in for 6 days.
So you say that you were obviously given your odds of coming out of it and coming through it. So how did you pass on the fact that you might have had a 40% chance of not coming out of this coma too? Have you children, Barra?
Yeah, I do. So at the time, my son was 19 and my daughter was 17. So they're not tiny tots by any stretch. So I had a conversation on WhatsApp with my wife and two kids. Now, I'm lucky because I've been working in conversational work and how to be good communicator and how to be good at better conversations probably for the last 4 or 5 years. And the irony was not lost to me from the hospital bed.
This was going to be one of the most important conversations of your life, perhaps.
The most, for sure. But what I did was I did less talking and more kind of listening to them, which helped them kind of process what was happening and find kind of positivity in their minds, which was very useful. Of course, I told them I loved them and I kind of offered sage advice to both the kids and then just told Jen, my wife, that we always said to each other, we'd find each other if one went before the other. So that kind of ridiculous saying, but I said it anyway. I said, look, I'll come find you if it doesn't work out. And but as I say, when they came to put me under.
What was the sage advice you give your children, if you don't mind sharing?
Kind of things like, for example, if one had a temper, I'd say, try don't be angry with this. This is nobody's fault. There's no one to blame for this. It's just something that's happened. That kind of stuff, that kind of,
God, you have an extraordinary, Barra, I'm picturing you. You haven't slept for God knows how long. You're in an ICU, there's machines everywhere. You've just been told that you may or may not come out of a coma. You have an extraordinary presence of mind to be able to have the clarity to have these kind of conversations.
I think my own personal research has really helped with that. But I also think that the doctors were incredible. When I woke up out of my coma, now I was only under for 6 days. When I came out of my coma, there was 12 consultants around my bed. Now, I've yet to figure... I found out eventually, I didn't know at the time why there were so many. But I was told, because I was the first person to come out of a coma in Lewisham ICU from COVID. Now, obviously, many more have followed, but I was the first one to wake up. They got the entire staff around the bed as a motivational tool to help them keep going. And that was really empowering for me. And they called me soldier and they kind of kept conversation. I was the only one in ICU who had woken up. So I was their only success story at that point.
So this is really, really early days of, this is back in March, very, very early days when really people were still learning a huge amount about how the pandemic was going through people's bodies. And
absolutely. Everything was experimental. What drugs to use, what to throw into my body during the coma was all guesswork. Thank God it worked. And I'd like to mention PTSD because your first contributor did. What I'd like to say about, I was lucky with the post-traumatic stuff, and I think The reason why was because even though I saw death all around me, and I saw, when I went into ICU first, there were 20 patients. When I was wheeled out, there were 60. And it has a capacity of 20. So it's trebled its patient care in the space, of 12 days because of COVID.
Yeah.
Those extraordinary things to watch and see. But I think because of the way they spoke to me, because I was skilled in conversations as well with them, it made me feel very much an equal partner. Like, consultants and doctors were congratulating my body and the way it reacted as much as the medicine, as much as the antiviral stuff. It really felt I was part of the team. I felt as smart as them. I felt like I was one of the consultants. That's how good I felt. And I wanted to get better, not just for me, but also for them.
Those consultants, though, I mean, they were learning on the job. They were facing, staring down the barrel at God knows what at that stage. They must have been, and you know, we had seen what had happened in northern Italy where they had to, you know, ration ICU service and all that. They must have been very frightened.
Scared. I mean, obviously you had the PPE everywhere, so all you could see were the eyes. But you could see fear in people's eyes, of course. You could also, I knew they were talking to the Italians. I knew they were talking to the Chinese as well. They were having telephone conversations right there in the ward about what treatment they should try next. All that kind of consultation was happening, which was really impressive. But young boys and young girls, doctors, nurses, the cleaners, you know, to a man, to a woman, they were all extraordinary. And, you know, obviously I have an emotional connection because they, you know, I survived. But, you know, take the emotion out. I can't believe I've ever worked a day in my life. You know, it's just embarrassing to think I've ever worked to watch those people in motion and what they do.
Because that is true work.
Absolutely.
And how are you now, Baron?
Yeah, I've been very lucky in recovery, Kate. I'm very, very lucky in recovery. I haven't had the complications, thank goodness, that other people have had. You know, I mean, the only thing that's changed is my head. You know, I prioritise things differently now. I look at life a bit more differently now. I keep my family closer to me now. I've changed my career as a result of what happened. I've thrown myself into the conversational work. I work with the NHS now. I do talks with them about what I went through during that particular 12-day period, 6-day in the coma, but 12-day in total in ICU, and kind of how to make those conversations better. Because some of the conversations I saw were awful, but some of the conversations I saw were brilliant. And it was those conversations that I'd argue are as important to your recovery, as I say, as much as modern medicine.
Yes, hugely important, isn't it? That communication that you say it motivated you, the way that those doctors and consultants and nurses spoke to you.
For sure. Katie, can I add, just it's all about listening. It's all about active listening. When the doctor gives you the time to listen to what you're saying, that's empowering. It gives you control over the situation. It makes you a player in the game. The way I listen to my kids and my wife when we had that conversation before I went into the coma, you know, it just gives them teeth, gives them some control over their own thinking process. It allows them to think. We jump in, we interrupt all the time. And, you know, it's just not conducive to good thinking.
Yeah. Barra, will you stay there? I want to go back to Lucy. And Lucy, are you still with us?
I am.
And I'm sure really interesting talking to Barra, listening to Barra there and his experience. How are you now? This was 10 years ago that you went through this.
What's interesting just to listen to Barra's story is it seems that he may have come out of it, brought out of the coma quickly, whereas mine was stages. Do you know what I mean? I was brought out of it in stages, so it was quite confusing. And quite like him, it has changed my whole life. First of all, I suppose I'm still a little bit disabled now. My arm doesn't work. My left hand doesn't work. My foot doesn't work so well. And all of those things that I was told that I wouldn't walk, that I wouldn't be able to use my hand, and that it was a waste of time working on my hand. When my partner was saying to them, look, can we just try? And they'd say, like, really, it's not going to happen. And he said, but I've heard of somebody. And they'd say, well, look, this, you know, let's be kind of clear, this isn't going to work again. I remember, like, being told I'll always be like a banana in the water, like if I want to swim. There was a lot of negativity. I know they were all doing their best, but the absence of hope was so scary. For my husband saying, you know, like, this is your hand of cards, we're going to play them as best we can, you know, and that really kind of set the tone then for my recovery. And like Barra, I would speak to trainee nurses or trainee therapists to say, look, don't ever underestimate hope, you know, please leave hope at least with somebody.
because with hope, I mean, I've done so many things that they said I wouldn't do, and it was sheer determination and you know, and the support of my husband that got me there, you know, that I tried things, I fell, I broke my arms loads of times, you know, and I remember one very kind doctor saying to me, look, we can wrap you up in cotton wool and you won't ever fall, you know, but then you'll never progress. You have to try and learn how to do things. And I did, you know. And so I got back a life. But initially in the hospital, I was crying an awful lot, not knowing that it was post-traumatic stress disorder. And nobody else seemed to know either. So, you know, if you got frightened before or if you had a panic attack before all this happened, I would just run around the house or whatever to try and breathe. But suddenly I couldn't do that anymore. I was trapped in the bed. I couldn't get out. And I was so, so scared. I used to cry and try not to let them hear me crying, because when I'd cry, they'd call down the psychiatric team. And I remember them saying to my daughter, who was in her 20s, has your mom had psychiatric treatment before? You know, this isn't like good that she's crying and crying, you know. Mm-hmm. And even then I tried, again, it was kind of a matter of survival where I said to the psychiatric team, I think it's quite normal to cry. I've been through something that none of you seem to know or understand. And I'm so scared. And wouldn't it be kind of weird if I wasn't crying? I've lost a lot. Wouldn't it be weird if I wasn't crying? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And that's then where Headway and Dr. Marcia Ward and Fionnuala in the NRH, Dr. Fionnuala O'Keefe, I always say the neurosurgeon saved my life, but the psychologist gave my life back to me. Do you know, they gave me purpose. I said, so what am I now? Like, I used to work in insurance. I used to teach drama. So what am I now? Am I going to be a burden on my kids, like, forever, you know? And they gave me kind of so many tools to work with, you know, which was kind of working on values of your life, what's important. And so, like Barrett, there's so many things that have changed so much for the better, you know. Every time I take a shower, I value the water pouring on my head because I can shower me. It's not somebody in plastic gloves or rubber gloves. Every time I go out and see the birds, you know, everything is so fabulous, absolutely fabulous, and I appreciate every single thing in my life now.
God, it's great to hear that positivity, and it's great to hear that you've got so much independence back. Will you stay with us? We'll stick with
this,
but we're going to take this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And before the break there, we were talking to Lucy and Barra, who were giving us a really fascinating insight into the experience of being in a coma and coming back from that. John Fitzgerald, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, John, you were in a car accident.
1919.
And you ended up in a coma as well.
Yes.
For how long?
I think it was 6 weeks. Well, I was 13, it's a good way for losing weight. I was 13 stone before the accident, and I was 6 and a half afterwards.
Wow. So you were actually completely comatose state for 6 weeks?
Yeah, I was in a coma, yes.
Were they worried they were going to lose you?
Well, my parents were told to expect the worst.
Yeah. And do you have any memory now? We were listening to Lucy there of her very, very...
Not much.
None. It was like being asleep.
Yeah.
And without dreams. You came out of it, obviously, John. We wouldn't be talking to you today. How are you now?
I'm grand. I'm working. I'm one of my parents reckon, well, they're past, I know, but my family reckon that I'm a totally different John to the John before the accident.
In what way?
I don't know. Because I don't think I am. But that's me.
So you feel the same?
Yep.
But your parents say...
My whole family say no. But I'm a camera persuade. But no, I can't hammer. I have no coordination. I can't climb a ladder. I shouldn't climb a ladder. I'm a civil servant at the moment.
But you've obviously made a good recovery. If you're able to work and.
Yes, but it was the accident was 1990. So, 31 years ago.
So it was a long road back.
My anniversary was the 19th of June.
Yeah. You, like that for Lucy and for Barra, it was like a life-changing experience for them. Did you look back and feel lucky that you're alive?
I do, of course.
And do you still remember the accident?
Not at all. No. So, I remember nothing of it.
What were you told about it? John.
It was my girlfriend's. I think my girlfriend's 21st.
Mm-hmm.
After that, dropping home at 3 or 4 in the morning, and I had the accident.
And that was that?
I was living in Dublin at the time.
And that's it. Stay with us, John. I want to bring Brendan in. Brendan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
You were also in an induced coma.
I was. I wasn't in it for as long as the other people. Mine was for 3 days. But I developed swine flu pneumonia.
Swine flu pneumonia.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long ago was that, Brendan?
5 years ago, approximately.
And you were put into did you have the conversations like the conversations Barra was describing there as you were being put into that coma?
No, I didn't realise. No, I was just too sick. And they were putting me, the reason they did it was to save my vital organs.
Right.
Because they didn't know what was wrong with me. So it took them 3 days to, obviously they took some bloods and that, and they grew them then, and then they ascertained that what it was, that it was swine flu, and they were able to give me something then to the antibiotic that would kill the swine flu, you know. So I just remembered, I don't remember anything about the, I didn't have any dreams, and I don't remember, I didn't even know I'd been in a coma the week after. But I remember when they woke me up, the doctor coming in just to say, we know that you have, we're going to cure it, you know, we're going to fix it. So, and I've never looked back.
And
so that's why I rang. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you, Brendan.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when you came around and the doctor said, we know what you have now and we're going to sort you out, did you think you had literally just kind of woken up from a sleep at that stage? You had no sense at all that you had been out for a few days?
I didn't, yeah. I don't have any recollection of being in a coma. I just, you know, I can't actually answer that question definitively, but I just remember saying to him, well, then just tell me what I have to do.
Yeah.
And that's it. I just never looked back from it. But the reason why I rang was just to, for anybody who has anybody who is in a coma or whatever, or anybody, you know, in the future, whatever, that there is life after it. You know, I'm completely healthy again, full health. I'm very lucky, thank God. Yeah,
absolutely no after effects at all?
None.
And
I lost all my lung capacity at the time because the swine flu eat into my lungs. But I have, for my age, I have full lung capacity.
Your family must have been so worried about you, though.
They were. Yeah, I'd say it was more traumatic for them than it was for me, I'd say.
Yeah.
I had the trauma of my body, but they had to look at it, so it's different, yeah.
Okay, Brendan, thanks for that. Thank you for sharing that. I want to go to Jerry Simpson now. Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
And in case people are wondering, yes, it is that Jerry Simpson, singer-songwriter Jerry Simpson, and also, of course, brother of Spider Simpson.
That's right, Katie.
Now, maybe you'll remind us, just for our younger listeners, Jerry, about Spider.
Yeah, Katie, it seems like a lifetime ago now. Spider, or Dermot Simpson, Dermot, what was his real name, was a singer-songwriter of amazing talent in the late 80s. And he toured around Russia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Britain. He was an amazing songwriter, an amazing guy at whatever he did, an incredible musician as well. and he had an horrific accident on the way to a gig. We were playing in a Mullingar, and through the accident he had severe head injuries and was basically in a coma for quite a while. But as neurology and the neurosurgeons have improved with time, what he would have went through at the time, you know, there wouldn't have been the support of the technology available that there is now.
No. But go back, I mean, I think, because a lot of people will remember, he was really the coming thing at the time. He had a fantastic look, a big head of blonde hair, kind of a Bowie-esque kind of image.
Very much so. I mean, he had done so much in so little time. I think the amount of Dermot Spider had done and the songs he had written, at the time we had supported AHA and the RDS. I mean, some of the biggest gigs, and the pop scene was so great then. And he was an incredible singer. But not alone that, he was a black belt in martial arts. He was so fit. He had all the moves. He had everything going for him, you know.
Yeah, God, such a thing. And the tragedy of that crash, there was two lives lost in that crash.
Indeed there was. We lost two of our band members, Andy Bergen and Paul Neville. They were both killed, unfortunately, at the scene of the accident.
And were they driving, what, just remind us again, were they going to or from a gig or...?
We were going to a gig in Mullingar, in the townhouse in Mullingar. And
were you in the...
I wasn't in the car. No, I'd gone ahead with the equipment with the guys. We were actually trying out a new PA system, so we'd gone on early to set up, and Dermot was driving the car with the other three members of the band. One more member was injured but made a full recovery, Alan Barton, who's the drummer.
Right. But as you say, two of Dermot's band members died that day, and Dermot had a very long road ahead. Was it 5 years?
It was, Katie. The accident happened in November 1987, and he died in May of 1992. And he had been basically in hospital and receiving all the care and attention that was available at that time. Like, Beaumont had only opened, I think that was 89. Mm-hmm. And my late mum and dad took Dermot back to our family home in Drogheda. And to be very honest with you, they nursed 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You know, did everything, you know, that was humanly and beyond human sometimes. Parents and mum and dad, the love of a child and the love of a son, it can bring people to extraordinary places that they just, you know, dedicate their own lives and their own existence just to caring, which is...
And how like that, I would thought that's quite an unusual scenario. I would have thought that somebody who was in a coma would be brought home and cared for at home. How long was he in hospital after the accident?
After the accident, it was 3 years, but there was regular visits over and back to the hospital, just with infection, with catheters, and, you know, the body just basically rejecting anything that wasn't of the body, you know. Mm-hmm. So it left him prone to infection. And
so he had some... So how many months in hospital then after the... Initially, before he was brought home?
It was probably about a year and a half, yeah.
And how, I mean, this must have had a massive impact on your entire family.
Yes, absolutely. It's life-changing. I firmly believe there's no greater love than a brother has for a brother, you know. And I was very fortunate to be so close to my own brother, to Dermot. If you ever saw a scenario whereby somebody would answer questions without asking them, that's the kind of the communication we had, because we're both into the same things, and, you know, we just know each other so well.
And did you feel that he could hear you when he was in this?
Yes. Oh, 100%.
Really?
Oh, 100%. Music, funny stories, jokes. You know, we were big fans of anything that was comedy and fun, like most musicians are into, you know, fun and comedy. And, you know, jokes that would make us laugh, things that we would have experienced, things we would have done. And, you know, when you talk to him and tell him the jokes, he would smile. And that smile was worth, that was worth everything, just to see that. You know, that was as good as the reaction got, but it was amazing, you know, to see and to feel and to know he could hear you, you know.
And that was right over, like, so you think over those years that he was in a coma, that that he was aware of what was going on around him all that time?
I do believe that. I do believe that 100%, yes. I absolutely do. And, you know, a strange thing that I should say, one of his greatest fears was ever to be trapped in his head. You know, and like his greatest, that would have been his greatest fear, because, you know, we'd spoken about things like that. And,
And did you think over those years, like, was there a hope that he would come back from that he would come out of that coma and recover?
There's always hope. One of your early listeners said there that one of the greatest gifts there are is hope. And she is so right. People who have recovered from comas and recovered from, you know, horrific neurological injuries, the road starts with the smallest step. It could be the blink of an eye. It could be the squeeze of a hand. And once recovery starts, it continues. And how far it goes, well, let's just hope for anyone that is injured like that, that it goes to a case that they can lead as normal a life as possible. You know, and just to...
But, and did he have that? I mean, you said he would smile if you told, you know, if you shared a joke.
Yeah.
So did you have that feeling when you saw that, that maybe, you know, maybe we will get him back?
Yeah, look... you never give up hope. You always hope beyond, you know. We were brought up, we were great believers in God and in prayer, and you know that there's a journey out there for each one of us to take, you know. And we just have to, you know, without the belief in God and the prayers and the hopes that we had, probably my own mum and dad could never have gone through it, you know. That's where family comes together. It's like some of your other callers had said about, you know, it's all about living for the family and living for the, you know, the people that you have. It's just that's your life, you know.
And of course, I'm reminded again, like, he was such a big star and such a rising star when he was cut down so young. I mean, he must have had a lot of fans, you know, inquiring and wondering and asking. And
oh, you know, it's a wonderful memory that you just reminded me of. The amount of fans that came to our house with flowers, with cards, with mass bouquets, with phone calls, it was just such a tribute to him. And it's still a tribute to him today, you know, that his songs are still played, his music is still alive. Shea Hennessy, who was the Dermot's manager for years from Crash Records, he's kept him alive. He's compiled videos that he had recorded, all the songs he had recorded. We compiled the whole lot and brought them out on a little collector's item for fans and for people to, you know, to remember him.
And I'm thinking about your parents as well. I'm thinking, like, to have somebody, you know, who can't move themselves,
yeah,
in that situation for those many years, the amount of care, just the absolute care that has to go into keeping that person going and in good health and minding that has to happen.
Oh, 24 hours a day. It really is. You know, my mum and dad would never get a break. You know, like, we were kids. We were living at home at the time. And, you know, everybody would do their bit. My sisters, you know what I mean, the whole family. But the mum and dad being the core, they were just there all the time. You know, every hour of every day.
And you're doing this while you're also, a part of you is grieving the boy you've lost.
Absolutely, you know, it's really about the memories. You just have to really savor the memories and cherish the memories. One of the ladies said there, you know, to see a bird flap its wings, to see a child smile, all the small things, and you don't take life for granted. You know, that's probably the worst thing that a lot of us are guilty of. You take the simple things and the beautiful things for granted, and you must never do that.
And then, of course, despite all of that care and all of that love and all of that attention, he left us on 1992.
That's right, yeah. He was back in hospital for a little operation. It was basically to try and so as his bowels and kidneys could function better. because he was just so prone to infection. Infection would bring on terrible pain, and it was, you know, there's nothing worse than to see someone suffer. So this was to try and help him, you know what I mean, to see if it could aid his recovery. But unfortunately, it wasn't meant to be, and after the operation, he got quite ill, and he developed septicemia, so unfortunately, he left us then.
Somebody has just handed me, one of our producers just came in and handed me the newspaper report of Dermot's inquest, and it actually refers to yourselves, Gerry, you might remember this, five family members, this is what the coroner, Brian Farrell, said, five family members effectively give their lives to his care.
Yeah.
And it was only by their attention he survived as long as he did. So you will always have that.
Oh, that's so true, Katie. You know, love can keep you alive. Of that, there is no doubt.
Gerry, it's so nice to be around. I'm sure many of his fans will be listening today and will be thinking, "Oh God, Spider Simpson! What an extraordinary talent he was." I think. I think we have. Gerry, we'll play a little bit of that huge hit he had. Ironically, I suppose called "Bye Bye," given what happened to him shortly afterwards. But
that's beautiful, Katie. Such a beautiful song. People love it.
Okay, let's do that then. And Gerry, so lovely to talk to you.
Katie, and to you as well. God bless and thank you.
God bless.
The only way that I can make sure that I get up and have a shower. I gotta leave in half an hour. I can't be late, 'cause this is our first time to see each other in 2 years almost to the day. It's been that long since you went away. Funny, but it always seems like yesterday. You broke the heart with the note you left. Look at my watch, it's a 1:15. Girl, I'm really hoping you feel just a little bit the way I do. I bought my car and rehearsed my lines, the ones I've read on so many times. How you doing, baby? Looking fine. And for the rest of my life, will you please be mine? Now you're standing there in front of me. You're looking better than you used to be. I hope to God that you will never leave, 'cause I love you and that you can't believe.
And that was "Bye Bye," and Spider Simpson there, his massive hit before tragedy struck. And thanks again to Gerry Spider, or I should say Dermot Simpson's brother, for bringing us that story of his last days and years.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And I was lovely there listening to Spider Simpson's hit "Bye Bye," and lovely talking to his lovely brother Gerry. What a great talker! What a great story! I want to go now to Patricia. Patricia, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
We were talking yesterday about children leaving school and graduations, and people not being able to go to graduations.
Sure.
Talk to us.
I was in a similar position. My son is in Sorry, my son is in leaving cert. So like that, he's my youngest son. It's the end of an era, et cetera, et cetera. Much like all the other parents were describing yesterday. And I really felt... Sorry, I've been working. I'm kind of out of breath. I really felt bereft. Like, it really felt like the loss of something. And I was an emotional wreck. That's the truth. As irrational as it may sound to some people, I was an emotional wreck.
You were an emotional wreck because you had nothing to mark this moment, or...?
A combination of everything is the honest answer. Parents, it's all about, you know, transition. You know, they leave nursery and there's a little bit of a ceremony and then they begin national school. Like, we're used to these, the transition being marked in some way. Like, mm-hmm. we're creatures of habit. You know, there's communions, there's confirmations, all the different things that people enjoy to mark transition. So I was kind of feeling, yes, the loss of it. But even though, you know, the school were fantastic, they done a great job, they had a beautiful maths, but the parents weren't allowed to go. So it kind of felt like, yeah, the loss of something. You know, was my son affected by that? No. I think he was quite happy at 18 yeah. years of age to leave his mother at home. I found it emotional. That's as short as I can make it.
And was it the fact that he's your youngest, Patricia, a touch of the empty nest syndrome creeping in there? And
yes, we won't pry too deeply there, because yeah, I think that there is a lot of that in it. It was the end of an era, much as many people described to you yesterday.
Yeah.
And I was kind of at a loss. And anyway, I had what I believe to be a little brainwave, and it certainly worked really, really well for me. I had the idea of writing him a letter.
Oh.
So I went and bought some nice paper. You know, I didn't. It wasn't a sheet out of an exercise book. I went and bought some nice paper, and I kind of charted from junior infants upwards, from my first day of having brought him into junior infants and leaving this little blondie-haired, smiling little boy there, to my now 6'4", blondie-haired, smiling son. So I kind of charted all the years, just with various stories, like moments that stood out. And, you know, there were a few of them where, you know, there was nice memories. And again, it's very much about transition. For me, you know, doing your leaving cert, you're an adult, you're transitioning to becoming a man. And it just gave me the opportunity to say some of those things, you know, the things that are really important, you know, honesty, integrity, kindness, you know, all the things that you would have taught your children all the years. But it was like a summing up. It was kind of a letting go. This is me summing up your childhood for you and putting it in writing.
What an absolutely lovely idea.
It was the most cathartic thing I've done. I felt like a weight had been lifted, hence me trying to pass that on, because, you know, a lot of the people ringing yesterday, I know there was one particular woman that really reminded me of myself. And it is, it's a way to mark the transition.
And was it appreciated by your son?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he would be a typical boy of 18 years of age. He wouldn't be overly emotional, et cetera, et cetera. He loved it. He absolutely loved it.
There is something so special about putting feelings and memories down in words. Isn't there? There's just something so special 100%. For doing it and that it's always there then.
Absolutely. And I really love, if I ever go into his bedroom now, it's still sitting by the side of the bed.
Oh.
So whether he's ever read it since, I've no idea. But I know, listen, we all of us are going to pass on at some point, and a lot of these stories will die with us. Because even at 18, he didn't remember some of the things I spoke about when he was 11. It was very much, oh my God, I'd forgotten about that. But so in years to come, he'll have these stories that really summed up character. Like, it's not about grades, it's not about trophies. It's about, for me, it's about character. It's who you are. Who are you going to go on to be? Like, excuse me, you know, as a man, it's kind of aspirations, my hopes for you. It was literally summing up childhood.
And you have, of course, now the first draft of the speech you're going to make on his wedding day.
Yes, I don't think he's quite ready for me talking about modern days.
But you called, as you say, Patricia, to tell people this is something that we should think about, because it was so rewarding for you and for your son.
It gave me something to do with all that emotion. My 18-year-old son had no interest in entertaining him, nor should he. You know, it's not his job. He was going through his own thing, you know, the Leaving Cert. Mm-hmm. He was going through his own thing. I had no business, and obviously I didn't discuss any of that with him. It was all internal, to the point, yeah, I was overly emotional. Mm-hmm. It just gave me a great focus for it, and I could then park it, because I thought, okay, yeah, you've done something with that. And it's, again, you know, I keep repeating it, it's the transition for parents. It's the marking of something. You know, there was one lady I felt so sorry for yesterday, who her son was finishing 4 years of college and is not getting this graduation, because we're all about marking these moments. You know, the white dress for communion, you know, the Debs, all these things that we all love to enjoy, which COVID has put a stop to for a couple of years anyway. Mm-hmm. And obviously important that we're all safe, and we have to find new ways.
Well, that is a lovely new way. And Patricia, I really do thank you for that, because I think that will have a lot of people thinking, yeah, that's something I want to do now. And maybe we will hear from more people who have gone down that road. But for now, Patricia, many thanks.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now, I want to move on and go to Lindsay Corr. Lindsay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kay. How are you?
I'm very well, Lindsay. How are you today?
Grand, I feel bad.
Yeah, Lindsay, you got in touch with us about, I think, a very important issue, and you think it's a very important issue. Explain to us your situation.
Well, my situation is I'm missing my left arm, and I'm currently in full-time employment. And I applied for a medal card, but I'm not awarded a medal card due to being in full-time employment.
Okay, so stop a second, go back. You're missing your arm. You were born with that disability.
I was born without my left arm, yes.
Right, okay, so it wasn't an accident or anything like that.
No.
So
no.
You've you know, dealt with this all your life. You're obviously doing grand. You have a full-time job.
Yeah.
But you use prosthetics for that arm?
Yeah, I use prosthetics for cosmetic purposes. Like, you know yourself, like, confidence-wise, you go out and I'd wear my arm, and just to kind of look a bit normal, I know. Like, but, yeah, like...
And just in relation to that, like, you know, coping from childhood with just one arm and one hand... You know, have you to learn how to do all basic stuff in a very different way?
Yeah, I'd have to do things in my own way. It might take me a bit of time, but I'd eventually figure it out. I suppose what you don't know, what you don't have, sometimes it doesn't affect you, you know, in a sense, in some way. But I have had my obstacles, but I've got through it.
Yeah, and of course, but the prosthetic that you use isn't something that is actually useful to you for, you know, it's not a motor, it's not something that can actually act as a limb.
No, it's just a basic prosthetic limb. It is that I have at the moment.
But it's still really expensive, though.
Yeah, they range from about 3,000 and can work up to 10, depending on the type of prosthetic that you want. So it would change kind of in price as you're growing. And if you're losing weight or putting on weight and you need bigger sockets, you need different kind of things. And it would change in expense, kind of custom to you. Like.
And you've changed in size for a very lovely reason in recent months.
Yes, I had a baby there 4 months ago. So I've actually put on a bit of weight. So the arm that I currently have is gone too small for me. Ideally, I'd need a new one, but I have to kind of make do with what I have due to expense and just get the one that I have repaired as it's damaged at the moment.
And And you sent us in some pictures of the damage that can happen to these prosthetics. Yeah, really basic stuff, that, you know, that they kind of crack and break.
Yeah, like you could be pushing, just use your arm to push open a door and it bend, or the fingers would bend and the sleeve would break or rip or tear. You wouldn't even notice it happened, and it just happens. You look down and the thing is ripped.
And your heart sinks because you know what that's going to cost.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what you're earning a salary that puts you outside the means test for a medical card?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
And like, can you get a tax break for this?
No, that's what I wish. Like, well, I could pay for the arm, or I could pay for a new glove, and I could claim it back a tax at the end of the year. That's what I could do. But ideally, in my eyes, I think people in my circumstances who are in full-time employment should be kind of tax exempt to help pay for the cost of arms, that the money just goes into a fund to assist in being able to pay for them.
It's just so much money. I mean, I don't know how you manage at all. How often would you need to replace, on average, these prosthetics?
Well, as you said, my heart sinks. Like, every few months, like, my arm would rip if I was actually getting it repaired. And now it's recommended to have two prosthetics by the hospital, one for if one is damaged, that you haven't have a spare to go to. But I can't even afford two of them. I've only one. But, yeah, you would easily go through two a year.
Two a year, and as you say, it could cost you, what, 5,000?
The basic prosthetic would be about 3,000. So mine, I'd say, is about 4, the one I have.
And so if you had two of those, 8,000, and that you'd have to, in, as it stands, buy those out of your after-tax income.
Yeah.
It's like buying a new car every year.
Yeah. It's like having a mortgage.
And there's no help at all from the HSC or from the Department of Social Protection for this?
No. I went to the social welfare, and they told me to take it up with the HSC. That's the HSC that I'd need to be really targeting in regards to the matter.
And there must be an awful lot of people in your position, Lindsay.
Yeah, there is. There's an awful lot of people. It's just that I don't think it's being talked about enough, and it's being noticed enough, and for some people to take action with. I think more people need to talk about it more, because it's an awful lot of stress, especially if you're at my age and you're trying to do well for yourself and try save for an actual house or in the future. It's very hard. It's very hard to do.
I mean, that's a huge expense, as I say, an after-tax expense, and that you have to deal with. You can't, you know, very well just not get one. I mean, you know, this is something that's important to you, I'm sure, for, you know.
It is for your own confidence. Like, you know how it is this day and age with the likes of Instagram, Facebook and all the social media websites. Like, our image is nearly everything. And for me, especially in the line of work that I do, like, I'm seeing people every day of the week. And
do you mind me asking what is your line of work, Lindsay?
I'm a kitchen designer. I work for one of Ireland's builder providers, and I design kitchens.
So you deal with the public in terms of what they want for their kitchen?
Yeah, I do indeed.
Right, so you feel it's very important that you have this prosthetic limb.
Definitely, like, if I'm sitting with a customer, like, and if someone's kitchen is coming to, just say, 10 grand, and I'm not looking presentable, why would they hand me over their money if I can't even look after myself? Do you know what I mean?
No, I'm sure, and I'm sure, you know, you're not suggesting for a moment, just in case anyone out there gets the wrong impression from what you're saying, that not having a prosthetic limb would make you unacceptable. But you're saying that when your limb gets damaged, when this prosthetic gets damaged, it looks bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I must say I am quite surprised by this, Lindsay. I had not known that there wasn't some sort of a programme out there to, you know, look after people in this scenario. Because I imagine that if you had maybe lost a limb through an accident, that there might be, you know, other programmes that could look after you.
Well, I feel like I'm being kind of pushed in a corner. Like, if I wasn't walking, or if I was walking in a job that was 20 hours a week, I'd probably have gained access to getting a medical card and getting a prosthetic, where I feel like I'm kind of being pushed, you know what I mean, out of your job to get assistance, to get help, which I think that's unfair. There's no other programmes out there that help in the situation. There's nothing there.
God, and now, you know what, you have enough to be going on with to have this, to have to deal with this on top of everything.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone has advice for Lindsay, or let us know if they have any thoughts on this, 51551 is our text line. Thanks for that, Lindsay. Wish you the very best of luck, and hopefully we will find out more about this, and we'll have more people on it. But now we'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Rebecca Cotter, good afternoon to you.
Hi, hello Katie.
We were talking there earlier in the programme about comas and people who were in comas and came out of them. You had this experience.
I did. A few years ago, yeah, I became very ill very quickly and was initially in an induced coma in the Lord's Hospital in Dublin after treatment wasn't working. I was seemed to be in respiratory failure, but doctors couldn't work out why. So I was transferred to St. Vincent's after about 2 weeks or so in the Lord's, and again, placed after a couple of days in Vincent's, placed in an induced coma. I was in intensive care for two nights, and then I was deemed well enough to leave. And unfortunately, on my second night off the ward, it developed chest pains, and then woke up almost a month later from a coma.
A month later?
Yeah, but we believe about 3.5, maybe closer to a month. Hard to tell with everything that's going on at the time, you know.
Wow. And that was even longer, actually, than Lucy, who we spoke to at the start of the programme. She was in a coma for 20 days. So yeah. she had an extraordinary experience of being in a coma.
I just came in on the end of that lady's story, actually. I did a bit too. I mean, I don't remember a whole lot of it. There are flickers. Obviously, you've been told a lot when you wake up. I had certainly some hallucinations that I remember very clearly. But I just remember there be, like, afterwards, you know, when I did wake up, having a sense of panic and fear and the unknown. I was completely, now, by the time I'd woken up, I had no movement, really. I had full respiratory failure. I had a kidney failure. None of my limbs moved. I'd had a trachee. I was basically on life support, and my family had been called, you know, to say goodbye more than once. So it was a long road back.
And you, what kind of hallucinations? Were they similar to what Lucy was? She had very traumatic, dramatic hallucinations.
I didn't actually catch now what Lucy said. Somebody, my sister just texted me during the show to say this topic was on. My hallucinations were, I don't know whether they were influenced by past memories or what, but I was fully convinced at one stage when I was coming out of sedation that I was in a Vietnamese prisoner of war camp.
Tinko.
Yeah, seriously. I had been to Vietnam several years prior to that, but I don't know whether it was to do with a lot of the nurses in ICU were Asian, so I just in my mind thought, oh, okay, I'm in Asia again. But to me, what were windows and shelves later on when I was had a clear mind, at the time they looked like posters, you know, of Vietnamese war heroes in their uniforms, and I believe that people moving around ICU and coming in and out of my room were soldiers who were injured, and the moaning and the beeping of machines were people running to tender to them. And I had, I mean, when you're in a bed like that, obviously I'm completely wired up, and the only thing that moved was my eyes. So I could see on a dialysis machine close to me that there was a paper, you know, say scissors for cutting tape. Mm-hmm. But in my sedated state, I believe that I could reach for this scissors and have it underneath the sheet in case I was in a Vietnamese war, prisoner of war camp and I needed to defend myself.
And during this time, your family, as you say, they obviously were, by your bedside for some of this.
Absolutely.
And were thinking the worst and praying for the best, no doubt. But
sure.
did they have a sense that you were hearing them or that you were going through some trauma or anything like that?
Yeah, I think at some stage some members did. Yeah, I think a lot of these hallucinations I would have been having were during the night, maybe when there was nobody there because I felt alone. Mm-hmm. There was nobody by my hospital bed. But my family said at times, I didn't do hand squeezing, but in particular when one of my brothers came from the UK, once I heard his voice, I was looking around the room for him. My eyes were opening and I was trying to follow him around the room. And that was maybe a week or so, maybe 4 or 5 days into the coma. But they were playing music for me. Yeah, they were talking to me. But I don't have any memory. I have one or two memories where I believe I remember squeezing my brother's hand and telling him I wanted to go home. But I don't know how clear that is. You know, it's just so hard to tell, really. But no, to the best of their knowledge, they knew I was there, but I wasn't communicating and I wasn't responding. But occasionally there were signs of life, for want of a better way, you know, that I would open my eyes and try to find somebody in the room.
Wow. OK, Rebecca, Mindy, thanks for that. Extraordinary. And you're well. Yeah. You're well now.
I'm fantastic. It was a 4-year recovery, yeah, but with the help of my family and an army of friends, yes, I'm very well. And just like that lady said, I'm the gentleman as well, that talk about taking the very small things for granted. I still appreciate being able to wash my own hair and to stand and walk, and I appreciate breathing by myself still. So there's a lot of goodness that comes out of serious stuff as well too, you know.
Perspective is a very powerful thing.
Surely.
That's for sure, Rebecca. Many, many thanks for telling us your story there. Okay. And I want to go now to Graham Monaghan. Graham.
Hiya, Katie.
You knew Spider Simpson, or you knew of him?
No, I just got into the car and I just caught the tail end of Jerry's interview, our piece on the phone with you. And I just wanted to say that I was in Beaumont. I was a 16-year-old and I was a patient in Beaumont when Spider was brought in.
Oh.
I remember for so well the family being around and coming in the social room at the end of the ward. And they were just such a lovely, lovely family. And that tragedy is something that has stayed with me since then, because it's not today or yesterday. And I just wanted to pass on my love to them, because they were just special people. And I would like to think that anybody who was on the ward at the time when they were there, when Spider came in and met that family, they'd all feel the same way. They were just the most beautiful people.
And of course, as a 16-year-old, you would have known about Spider Simpson that time.
Yeah. And I remember I was given, in my text, I can't remember whether it was a member of the family or whether it was Spider's manager, but they gave me a lovely tape, an audio tape, which was actually, I think, a demo tape of Spiders. And when you played Bye Bye there earlier on, the tears started rolling when I heard it, because I remember the tape so well. And no, I just wanted to pass on, really, this to everyone in Beaumont at that stage who is a patient there, are dealing with a lot of difficult things and a lot of issues. And I was in for a brain scan and I had brain surgery at the time. And but a family like that, and there were so many wonderful people that I did meet in my time through that hospital, but the Simpsons is a family that I will never, ever forget. They were just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and I think anyone who listened to Jerry there would know that. It really came across so strongly. What a lovely man and what a lovely family. And Graham, many thanks for...
No, I wanted to concur. They were the most wonderful people, and I'm just now recently turned 50, and they will always, always hold a very dear place in my heart. And I send them love.
I'm sure Jerry's still listening, and I'm sure that is appreciated. Graham, many thanks for taking the trouble to call in with that. That's all we have time for. Today's programme was produced by Rebecca Meehan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. On sound was Cara O'Hare. And our BCO today was Daniel Keating. Stand by now for Catherine.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.